are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, June 25th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, journalist Matt Stroud, author of Thin Blue Lie, The Failure of High-Tech Policing. Also on the program today, President Trump denies rape allegations as the accuser not hot enough. Meanwhile, 300 children removed from appalling conditions in a Texas concentration hangar. And as the war of words escalates, Mitch McConnell short-circuits the Senate's attempt to stop aggression versus Iran. And the White House, meanwhile, creating all sorts of bizarre new legal theories to obstruct congressional oversight. Meanwhile, Lula gets a hearing in a Brazilian Brazilian Supreme Court. And on the eve of the debate, Joe Biden holds steady. Bernie and Warren gain in a national poll. Beto O'Rourke, however, introduces his war tax.
Just run for Senate, dude.
And Stephen Moore's last refuge. If he can't sit on the Fed of the United States, then he'll make his own central bank for crypto. All this and more on today's program. Yes, that is not a joke. That is the truth.
Oh, man. A lot
couple of
marks.
Things. I don't generally tease stuff that will come up in the show because it's always just usually just great anyways. And it would seem redundant to do that. However, today we came in. There was, of course, a huge blockbuster report by James O'Keefe on how Google is suppressing the right. And little did we know, and people probably don't know about this because it partly because it's fictional. We have a Dropbox, a digital Dropbox, where we can get all sorts of leaks and whatnot. And someone leaked to us the first cut of the famous, now famous, Google insider interview that James O'Keefe did. And this one's even more devastating.
I'm not sure why we want to play it even.
They're leaving a lot on the cutting room floor.
It's amazing. But we will play that later in the program, so make sure you stick around for that. Thank you for joining us. We have a full complement of people here today. For your listening pleasure, let's go right in to Donald Trump is attempting to argue that, well, let's start with number three first, and then we'll go to number two. Does that make sense? Donald Trump, of course, engaged in a war of words with Iran. And, of course, what better way to demean your enemy than to forget that they're dead? Here is Donald Trump saying that he has signed an executive order to further sanctions against Ayatollah Khomeini, who died over a decade ago.
Doesn't save you.
Sanctions imposed through the executive order that I'm about to sign will deny the Supreme Leader and the Supreme Leader's office and those closely affiliated with him and the office access to key financial resources and support. The assets of Ayatollah Khomeini and his office will not be spared from the sanctions. These measures represent a strong and proportionate response to Iran's increasingly provocative actions. We will continue to increase pressure on Tehran until the regime abandons its dangerous activities and aspirations, including the pursuit of nuclear weapons, increased enrichment of uranium, development of ballistic missiles, engagement in and support for terrorism, fueling of foreign conflicts, and belligerent acts directed against the United States and its allies.
Now, first off, I mean, how many more sanctions can we impose on Iran?
Well, these are distinct. I mean, these are ratcheting up and getting, you know, targeting specific members of the government.
I don't know why that wasn't started the first time.
Well, to the extent they were rolled back as part of the deal, I think. I mean, I thought
that's what we had changed when we left the deal.
Well, when we left the deal, the first things they hit were things like medicine and others. So, if Trump's concerned about 150 people dying, the sanctions have already killed well over that.
So the Ayatollah Khomeini, of course, has been dead for decades. And
that's right.
Apparently, nobody knows that in the White House, or I don't understand how that happened.
Khomeini.
Do you think he pronounced it? He just pronounced it wrong.
I would be shocked if he. I don't know if he knows the difference, but it's a close enough pronunciation that somebody like Trump could easily screw it up.
All right. Well, there you go. But more importantly than Trump not really having done a first pass read on that is that Trump is convinced and. Look, Donald Trump obviously has no sense of how our government works. So to the extent that he has an opinion on the separation of powers, it is a function of what he's being told by his advisors. Advisors who we now know are extremely invested in the United States attacking Iran. And here he is explaining how he does not need congressional authorization to strike Iran.
I like the idea of keeping Congress abreast, but I wouldn't have to do that.
Sure. But Nancy Pelosi actually said you must have congressional approval. So you disagree with her on that?
I disagree. I think most people seem to disagree. But I do like keeping them. They have ideas. They're intelligent people. They'll come up with some thoughts. I actually learned a couple of things the other day when we had our meeting with Congress, which were, I think, helpful to me. But I do like keeping them abreast, but I don't have to do it legally.
Someone does not want sole responsibility for a disaster. Right,
back check. He's never learned anything.
Right.
And they're saying that this is covered under the AUMF, which is why they've been regurgitating a lie about Iran being connected with Al-Qaeda, which is an even more like extravagant lie than Iraq being connected with Al-Qaeda.
And it also, emphasizes what a big deal and what the necessity, the Democratic Congress, anyways, the Democratic House, rolling back the AUMF. So, obviously, not you need the Senate to sign off on that, and you need it veto-proof. But that's a big deal, moving at least in the correct direction. Hey, folks, one of today's sponsors is Skillshare. Anyone who goes to skl.sh/majorityreport4 is going to get 2 whole months of totally free access to Skillshare's entire library, super quality online courses and tutorials. Skillshare is a vibrant online learning community that offers courses on everything from design to video editing, photography, business, technology, cooking, meditation, everything in between. There are Skillshare courses for everyone. You'll have no problem finding courses that will be useful to you, both in your personal and professional life. Whether you want to sharpen your skills with something you already love doing, or when you want to learn something totally new, Skillshare has you covered. They got courses for entrepreneurs. They got courses on computer coding. They got courses on web development. They got courses on personal nutrition, learning new languages, Photoshop, you name it. Now, my plan was this past weekend to get into some of that, what do you call it? The conscious dreaming? What is it?
Lucid dreaming.
Lucid dreaming.
You should know this by now.
And I had the lucid dreaming. I got to pull this up here. I had lucid dreaming queued up for me.
It was 1982 in Worcester. My mother was reading me a Social Security report.
I was going to use this because I've starred a bunch of ones that I'm going to do. I was going to use this productivity with Evernote because I've been trying to figure out how to use that for a long time. Productivity habits that stick, using time theming. And, of course, I got completely waylaid because I haven't taken these yet and by my kids. So I know when I'm doing this, the July 4th recess that we'll be on. I'm going to be doing a bunch of those. Folks are going to see a marked change in my productivity. And now you can get 2 entire months of free access to every single course offered by Skillshare by going to skl.sh/majorityreport4. Just think of everything at your fingertips for 2 whole months. Again, that's skl.sh/majorityreport4. I put a link underneath this video. If you're watching on YouTube, if you're listening to the podcast, it's in the podcast description. Check it out. Really cool stuff. Stuff that I think you'll be happy to learn. Should always continue to learn, folks. Very important.
Like Trump in meetings with Democrats.
With Trump in meeting with... In fact, let me see if there's a... Nope. Not a class on that. On bipartisanship. We're going to take a quick break. We come back. Matt Stroud. We are back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program CEO and executive editor of Post Industrial Media and author of Thin Blue Lie, The Failures of High-Tech Policing, Matt Stroud. Matt, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Sam. Thanks for having me.
So, I mean, let's just start with by what measure are you measuring the success or failure of this element of policing, this introduction of sort of high-tech equipment?
Well, I'm not a statistician. It's more, I'm a journalist, and so I'm relying on what I've seen in my reporting. And really the crux of what I started with and a lot of the reporting that I do in the book is built around the taser weapon and the company that created that. And so what I'm looking at is the promises of the taser weapon when it was first introduced, and when Jack Cober, the inventor of the taser, decided that he was going to take it to different police departments and try to sell it, and what he was telling those police departments, and how it has evolved over time and how it's used. And so a weapon that is pitched as being a non-lethal weapon and is pitched that way for you know, years and years, that ends up being involved in the killing of more than 1,000 people, I view that as being negative.
Right. Okay, good. So, I mean, that is, so let's start with that, the promise of the taser. What was the thinking behind the taser? And give us a sense. I mean, this is basically something that came into its own, I guess, around the turn of this century. But tell us what led to the development of the taser, and then what ostensibly it was supposed to do for us.
The taser was developed in the wake of police incidences that will be familiar to anyone who is listening to this show, right? So in the 60s and 70s, you had incidences of extreme violence that were going on between, you know, people in the community and the police in big cities, in Los Angeles, places like that. And this guy, Jack Cover, who was an engineer and an executive with Hughes Aircraft, saw these things happening and said, you know, I think that there is a market for a non-lethal weapon. And he had the innovation. He had the idea that he wanted to take an electric fence and shoot it out of a gun. That was the idea. And the concept beyond that was that he wanted to give police a non-lethal tool that could de-escalate a situation immediately without having to kill or beat or otherwise brutalize somebody on the street. So that's where it started.
I mean, those sounds like fairly, I think, legit goals. What tell us how it developed.
Well, over the first, you know, 10 years or so, Jack was not very successful selling the weapon at all. But then after in the wake of a woman being killed in Los Angeles by LAPD officers, Eula Love is her name. There was a lot of consternation. There were protests about her death, and the LAPD decided that they were going to have to look for a non-lethal tool like this. And so they went and purchased a weapon. What happened over years, though, you know, Jack Cover had his companies, which, you know, largely failed, and then two brothers from Scottsdale, Arizona, picked up the idea and changed the patent to strengthen the power of the device itself. And so that's really what happened over the years. Like, Jack Cover developed a device that seemed, through his research, to be safe, like it was non-lethal. Though he told people when he was selling this, you know, there's no guarantee that this is not going to kill people, but basically I believe that it's going, the power levels are set so that it won't actually cause people to go into cardiac arrest. And police over the years started asking for a stronger and stronger and stronger weapon. They were finding that they would use it on suspects and the power wasn't sufficient enough to bring them down, bring them to the ground. And so they asked for increased power, and the Smith brothers decided to do this. I mean, Jack Cover did it initially, ramped up the power, and then the Smith brothers ramped up the power quite a bit. To 26 watts was eventually where they got. And when it was ramped up to that power level, they became more and more dangerous, and so that's where we ran into problems of people being tasered and then, you know, dying.
When was essentially it follows that LA the adoption by the LA Police Department? When was the sort of like broader? When did we hit 50% saturation? Let's say.
Oh, that's a tough one. So they're at about 100% saturation right now.
Right.
I would say that they were going through their biggest period of growth around 2003, 2004. But I don't have the SEC documents in front of me now. I would say that, go ahead.
Well, I guess I'm asking because there's a couple of things that are going on there. It seems to me that at that point, you're starting to get police departments having a lot of Department of Homeland Security type funding. How much of this was a function of it being adopted by the LA Police Department? How much of it was a function of we have a budget now for stuff like this?
Well, there were federal dollars that were put toward this kind of weapon in the wake of 9/11. I think a lot of it was branding and marketing. Like Taser International did some really interesting work by essentially deputizing police officers to be trainers. And so they would go into, you have a police officer from one organization, from one police department, goes into a police department in another part of the county, say, and they train officers there on how to use the taser. And then in the process, you know, it's like a Mary Kay Cosmetics thing. They're selling as well as training how to use it, like a Tupperware party kind of. And so this was happening all over the country. Because of that, because of the attention that Taser was garnering, because it was kind of a new and interesting tool that was being used by police departments, and also because it was a publicly traded company and they were doing a lot to market the business on Wall Street and around it, you had a lot of attention being paid to this weapon. So, you know, yes, it was the federal dollars becoming available that allowed police departments to spend a little bit more money on it, but since it was being marketed and since police chiefs around the country, remember there are 18,000 police departments across the country, as they get more and more information about the taser and they realize that their police want it, they start lobbying, you know, city councils and mayors to allocate funding for these weapons, and it spread.
And so give us a sense of its failure. I mean, do we know, I mean, I guess it's hard to sort of say, like, how many people would be dead if we didn't have tasers? But I imagine, like, I mean, do we have a sense of how many times these things are unholstered versus guns? Like, what are the measures in which you use to sort of, I mean, if 1,000 people are dead, then clearly it has not necessarily decreased, I guess, deaths at the hand of cops, or has it? I mean, because we don't really have enough data on all of this on some level, do we?
That's part of the argument that I'm making in the book, is that we really don't know. There really aren't metrics to tell us whether these weapons are effective or not. And so all we can do is look at the periphery. So even the deaths, like, there's no federal agency that's looking into the number of people who were killed by police officers using taser weapons. Like, the count does not exist. There was a blog, the resource right now, the main resource that has been counting the number of people killed by tasers, is a blog made by somebody whose brother was killed in a circumstance where a police officer used a taser. This is outside of Toronto. And her blog is called Truth Not Tasers. And every time there's a media report of somebody dying after being shocked with a taser, she puts it there. And so that's been the number. And then there was a Reuters investigation a couple of years back that backed up a lot of what she had done and came up with their own count. And also, you know, they verified that it was over 1,000 people who had been killed by these weapons. And so that's a metric you can look at. There are also reports that have come out from different agencies themselves, talking about the failure rate of tasers. There was a study, an internal study that was shared in a media story out in Los Angeles through the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department that showed that tasers, they failed half the time. Like, so half the time they were unholstered and used on a suspect, they would fail. And so we have data like that show at least where the question should be about whether these devices should continue to be used. And we have some idea on what should be collected, what data should be collected. But you're correct. There's really not a lot for us to base our decisions on from verifiable sources.
What is the perspective of police that you've interviewed as to tasers? I mean, is there a general sentiment about them? Do they like them at this point? I mean, I understand you write that, you know, early adoption, people were pretty excited about it. Is that enthusiasm for tasers still there?
I think with a lot of police that I spoke with, there was, mostly because it's another tool that they can use, right? It's another weapon that, you know, they can have on their belt, that they have access to if the circumstance should require it. But most of the cops I talk to don't use them very frequently. And when they use them, it's an anomaly, which is, you know, ultimately a pretty good thing. The marketing for by Taser International early on was Taser early and often. And I think enough attention has been paid by, you know, people in media, as well as, you know, people in courtrooms. I mean, Taser International has been sued many, many, many times. A lot of this stuff has gotten attention. I think because of all of that attention, police officers tend to try to use tasers as infrequently as possible. But you do still see, you know, videos pop up all the time of people, police officers who are in circumstances where it really doesn't seem like they should be using a weapon, where somebody's unarmed or, you know, has their hands behind their back and they're sitting on the ground and all of a sudden an officer reaches for a taser. That's really what we're trying to avoid here.
So, all right. So tasers are, I guess you would say, tactical technology, right?
Sure.
You also write about the CompStat system, which is more of like a strategic, I guess, a technology. Tell us about that and its efficacy.
CompStat was basically the first tool that was used to try to take police data and use it in a way that was, as you say, strategic. Like, you know, what Bill Bratton and Jack Maple, who were leaders in the NYPD, had done prior to taking leadership roles at NYPD is they would look at crimes and they would get crime statistics, and then they would plot those points where crimes had occurred onto a map on a wall. And all CompStat was, CompStat did two things. First of all, it allowed them to use computers to map out where those crimes were happening. And then so that they had some real strategy about how to go after specific crimes and how to identify when specific crimes were happening in certain areas and how to approach those, they would have these regular meetings with everybody, all of the precinct commanders in the NYPD, where they could talk about the numbers and what the numbers showed and how they were planning to go about stopping the crimes as they were happening. And so that is CompStat on a very basic level and how it developed. So we talk about that in the book.
And my understanding, as you write, is that it's the sort of the secondary implications of CompStat that were really the most effective aspects about it. Is it basically gave everybody, it's almost as if it asked the right questions, and it required middle management, I guess, to show up and answer the questions and think about the questions.
Yeah, that was part of it. I mean, strategy is really the key here. It got police thinking about, okay, here's some data. Here are actual figures that we can look at that show us what's happening on the street. And now we need to think about how to approach, you know, where some problems emerge after that is in, you know, the aggressiveness that a lot of those precinct commanders would take in trying to, you know, stop crimes as they were occurring. It got to be pretty brutal.
And to what extent was this a technology that traveled throughout the country?
I mean, it has traveled throughout the country pretty significantly. CompStat is the precursor to predictive policing, and I said it before, there are 18,000 police departments in the United States. A lot of them are really small. And so the smaller departments that I'm familiar with aren't using analytics as much as larger ones, but basically every major police department in the country is using a crime statistics and predictive analytics or, you know, analytics of some sort to figure out, you know, which crimes are happening and how they can deploy resources to best take advantage of it. So it's, I wouldn't say that it's 100% market saturation, but it's probably, you know, 70-75% of police departments use data in a way that follows along with what was started with CompStat.
Has it been successful?
I think that the use of data has been helpful for police departments to understand how they should deploy their resources. And so it's been helpful in that way. Like, police understand better, like, who they're arresting and who they want to be arresting. I think where it has been unhelpful is where you end up deploying resources to places where, you know, police officers are essentially fueling, they're sending resources to places that are high crime areas, and all of a sudden, and those areas end up becoming places where they conduct more arrests, and you're having high crime areas that are just being flooded with police officers, and it's a self-fulfilling prophecy that you have, you know, data that is pointing you in the direction of a particular neighborhood, and then all of a sudden you have many police officers there that are conducting more arrests and making that area worse, and conducting surveillance in those areas. And so, you know, that kind of expansion of CompStat has moved in the wrong direction, I think. But data is always helpful for doing policing better.
So how much of this dynamic overall is a function of, I mean, we have significant drops in crime all across the country. I mean, there are some spots where it hasn't been as dramatic, and maybe some spots where, you know, there hasn't been really a drop per se. But in almost every category of serious crime, it has been dropping precipitously over the past 20 some odd years now. Right. How much of this dynamic, and nobody's really quite sure why. I mean, the theories range from, you know, barring lead in gasoline to, well, I mean, that's a legit theory.
Absolutely.
That I think, you know, there's some data that supports it internationally as well, that 25 years after lead is taken out of gasoline, there's a big drop in crime, and it seems to be durable, whatever has caused this this drop in crime. How much of what we see going on is sort of police departments having to, I don't want to say busy work, but I mean having to create a narrative that suggests that that police work is really the way to inhibit crime, as opposed to other factors? I mean, obviously, obviously at the margins, right? Police work has, you know, obviously implications. But if the biggest drop in crime that we've had, you know, possibly ever in the context of the country, is really a function of just environmental factors that were, you know, a bank shot on something that nobody anticipated, but we're just not pumping neurotoxins into the air. how much of what police departments are doing today is a function of trying to build a narrative that their work is perhaps more responsible for this drop in crime than it is? I'm not suggesting there's a conspiracy, but I'm just saying that, like, you know, everybody likes to think what they're doing is important.
Yeah. I mean, police chiefs, in particular, police leaders are always going to go to the government leaders in their cities and try to get an increased budget. They're going to try to get funding to do more things. I don't know that you can say, like, who would be in charge of that marketing effort that you're talking about, right? To make it seem as though police are more responsible for the drop in crime than they are. So I think that you always have police leaders who are making the argument that their budget should increase, that they should have more cops on the street, that their work is valuable. And I think that happens. What is always surprising to me is that while they could argue for increased budgets to bring on more police officers, they have been moving in the direction of making budget requests to get the kinds of tools that I write about in the book. So, you know, body cameras, tasers, facial recognition technology, and all of that stuff is really expensive. And so it has surprised me in researching this book how much of the lobbying and marketing that police leaders are doing is now being directed toward trying to get funding to purchase these tools rather than expand the footprint of the police department and get more people hired. And I'm not sure why.
I was just about to ask, why do you think that is? Is it a function of there's a push dynamic that's going on, that there are, that union leaders aren't pushing as hard as, people who can come in with smaller, sort of technological innovations? Or is it, having had a little bit of exposure to police, there's also sort of a quality of some elements of the police like to have a gear. And that it just sort of makes you feel good. I mean, I guess that was more of what I was asking. Not that there's someone who's conspiring to make it seem like what they do is having impact on crime. But I mean, I can tell you if I have someone on my podcast team who's in charge of social media, that becomes the most important thing that can be done to grow the show. Right. I mean, that's just inevitable. And so it's we need to get this technology to do our Instagram account or whatever it is. I mean, so I guess that's what I'm trying to get at is what are the forces that are driving the increase in technology, and why is that not as inhibited by expense in a way that if we could put, 10,000, 20,000 more police on the streets and have them more just engaged in the community and maybe less, surveillance and more just sort of service type of stuff?
I mean, you'd have to have a complete change in a lot, right? So one of the things that I think is contributing to what we're talking about is that there are big companies now that are marketing these tools to police departments, and they have meetings. The International Association of Chiefs of Police has an annual meeting every year at a different city, and you go to those events and there is an entire room, conference room, filled with all the different kinds of tools and technologies that you can purchase. So I think there's a bit of a geek factor there. I think there's also a bit of a factor related to police thinking of themselves and thinking when I retire, there is an opportunity for me to get into this business. Mm-hmm. I think there's some of that going on. I think that police leaders are just being marketed to so intensely, and they are thinking maybe this is a necessary tool. Maybe this is going to allow me to do more with less. And that kind of thinking happens quite a bit, and they're being pitched to constantly with that kind of message. And so I think that I call it a police industrial complex. And that is what I think it is developing into. And that is part of the reason why you don't have the kind of, union expansion and pushes for more hiring that replaces this idea of marketing for these tools and these businesses. There's business there and people want to make money.
Where is that money coming from that they're expending? Is it coming at the
police are expending?
Yeah. Is it coming at the expense of hiring?
You and me.
What's that? Well,
you and me.
No, but I mean, has there been an increase? Dollars. I mean, is it an increase in local dollars? Is it there more federal dollars going in there? I mean, presumably, are they doing it at the expense of actual cops? Right. I mean, if they're buying an increase in technology that there was no market for 20 years ago, is that money coming in an increase in taxes? Is it coming because there's other things being cut? Is that taxes local or is that taxes federal that money's going back to these police departments?
I mean, you have increasing budgets for police just across the country. And, I pull out some numbers in the book, but the increase is astronomical in the amount of real money and real dollars that has been expended on policing. It's really a lot of money that's being spent. And so, every government is different. I keep on saying that there are all these police departments around the country, 18,000 of them. Each one of them is going to be unique. There's going to be different parts of budgets that are going to be overtaken by police budgets all over the place. But, you know, there are additional federal dollars that are being pumped into police departments to pay for technology. You know, one of the most prominent recent examples being in the wake of Mike Brown being shot and killed by Darren Wilson in Ferguson, Missouri. You have a $75 million block grant that's allocated to police departments that want to purchase body cameras. So there is an infusion from the federal government to pay for these kinds of tools, but it's also city leaders making decisions that, yeah, well, I guess we need to spend more money on tools and weaponry and on police in general. And so that's been a trend over the last, you know, 40, 50 years.
It's fascinating stuff. Matt Stroud, the book is Thin Blue Lie, The Failure of High-Tech Policing. Thanks so much for your time today. We'll put a link to that book on majority.fm.
Thanks so much, Dan.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. Let's do a couple of things. First off, some breaking news that just came across my transom, as it were. According to the New York Times, the acting border protection chief is resigning. John Sanders expected the acting one, because we don't have an existing one anyways, is expected to step down as public fury mounts over the treatment of detained immigrant children. Comes as the Trump administration said it was transferring children back to the Texas shelter that was criticized for overcrowding and filthy conditions. I heard a report from one of the lawyers. It's not the lawyer that we played yesterday, but one of the other lawyers who apparently they tour these facilities. And they generally don't go public with anything that they see. It's a way that they can sort of like advocate for folks without it being sort of politicized, I guess, in a way where they can work with people. But they said that what they found was so appalling that they had to go public with it. But the story was that they were in the facility and they had seen like an increase in numbers and they couldn't quite figure out how this was possible because the facility was only supposed to hold like a third of the number of kids that were on the docket. And they were going down the docket and all the numbers of the ages were 0, 1, 2. And apparently they were driving around the facility and they saw what amounted to one of those like prefab steel buildings that you can buy, right? You must see those up in, you know, you see them in rural areas. You can buy prefabricated steel buildings that are basically just hangars. They, you know, will be the size of like a large hothouse type of thing, but no windows. And apparently that's basically where they were warehousing these kids. And this is, you know, what our country does. So we're number one.
God, when right-wing ghouls are quitting and or getting fired because they don't want to enforce this stuff, you know it's bad.
Well, that's the question. It's unclear from this story whether this person is resigning in protest or is resigning because they say we have to make it look like we're doing something. Like the problem isn't the policy, it's the personnel. So we're getting rid of you as some type of like a sacrifice to the gods of here it is. This is there's more here. The official who confirmed his resignation, who requested anonymity because he was not authorized to discuss the matter, said it was not clear whether the impending resignation was connected to recent criticism over the agency management of a large influx of migrant families across along the border. Even that, even if it was associated with the criticism, it's not clear whether this is someone who had a conscience or someone who was like, oi, this is going to be bad for me. How am I going to advocate for this private prison gig that I had lined up if I'm associated with the guy who puts babies in steel hothouses? Or if it's just a matter of Mick Mulvaney saying, we got to make this story go away. who do we got to fire to make it look like we fixed the problem? Here's the, and I don't think this is going to come as a surprise to anybody listening to the sound of my voice right now. There is no getting rid of middle management personnel to take care of this problem. We're getting rid of an acting person who's probably the second or third acting head of whatever division this is. There is a problem that obviously this is an ideology. This is an ideology. Donald Trump and those people who elected him are promoting and are encouraging, which is not to say that there wasn't deep problems with our immigration policy prior to Donald Trump, but the sadism, the impetus for this stuff, it's horrific. It really is horrific. We may talk a little bit more about that as a thing, but we'll obviously follow this story. Should we do the scoop? Yeah, the scoop. But also, this is amazing. Take a look at this. There's a contest. I don't know if I want to get into this. Oh my gosh. You're all going to freak out. You see this? So just as a public service, let me just read off this Andrew Yang tweet. I will give $1,000 a month for the next 12 months free to someone who retweets this and follows me by July 4th. Let's show why money is the answer and why this is the campaign for people. No purchase necessary. U.S. citizens only.
Man,
I just don't know how much I want to spend, having my Twitter mentions.
Careful. That gang can be very menacing.
Oh, whatever. Don't be like that. They're fine. They're fine. I just feel bad for all the asthma attacks we're causing when we criticize them. But, I wanted to give him credit because he has come out sympathetic to Bernie's debt relief proposal. But then he's got to do this. Andrew. Andrew.
Hey, at least they took SSDI off the table.
Did they?
You saw that they clarified that it's going to be SSI, but not SSDI. So,
you know what? Look, why can't you just say in addition to Medicare for all, free college, and a complete universal system funded by things like Wall Street taxes, I say add UBI onto it. I'll meet you halfway.
Yeah, but the reason he said disability instead of specifying at the beginning is because he wanted to talk to both sides of his mouth at the same time.
Well, look, I don't have any sense of why he did this, but I mean, did we misinterpret what he said to Dave Rubin?
Oh, no. He's since clarified that when he said disability, he wasn't. SSDI is safe, so he just means SSI.
Social Security insurance.
Yeah.
He wants to get rid of Social Security insurance.
That's one
of
the things that he's going to get rid of, but I said SSDI.
I'm sorry, wait a second. He wants to get rid of Social Security insurance?
That's one of the things that will not stack with Yang Bucks.
Social Security, as in Social Security?
SSI, I don't know. I don't think it's just basic Social Security. I think SSI is a separate program. I'm not an expert on it.
I have to look into it.
You mean like the stuff that like Paul Ryan got? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm not
like,
sure.
Like orphan and widow?
It could be stuff like that. I think there's about 6 million people that exclusively get SSI and not any other of those programs.
Man, if Paul Ryan knew he could just get a direct cash transfer, he would have killed his dad.
So supplemental security income.
Oh, those are welfare programs, right?
Yeah, and they're unapologetic about canceling those.
Well, right, yeah, and that's the libertarian kind of right-wing tinge of it.
It seems you've engaged in quite a bit of discourse about this subject while I was away.
But what was he referring to when he said, when Dave Rubin said, all these welfare programs are boondoggles.
Should I pull it back up?
Yeah, let's go back over this again. I really didn't want to do this.
Oh,
but,
my God. This is a Godfather 3 moment.
But wait a second.
The Yang Gang pulls us back in.
I just want to know, if I follow him right now, am I eligible for the $1,000? You got a retweet?
Yeah, and it can't be like a smart-ass quote tweet. It's got to just be a straight-up retweet.
I feel like I would do it for $5,000. Or a guaranteed $250 a month. Like, I would either do it for, like, to go into the lottery for $5,000, or if you gave me a guaranteed $250 a month, I would do it. But yeah, let's just listen to it again. Maybe I misunderstood, because I want to be, you know, like, I've been quite clear about my problems with the UBI. Michael sort of alluded to it there, is that I am totally down with giving cash universally to everyone as long as it doesn't eliminate. And yes, there are programs that I think are problematic. AFDC was better than TANF because we had a problem when we realized when there weren't as many jobs. I have a problem with block granting this stuff and allowing certain states dealing with it. Yes, I do. But the idea that it's conceptually, like, you're not even going to talk about the program, just the idea of providing things like automatic economic stabilizers that kick in during times when the economy is gone south, when people lose jobs, or stabilizing when people have, you know, other sort of financial, catastrophes. Or just broadly support for folks who have a higher need. I have a problem with eliminating that, generically speaking. But maybe he said something more specific in this and I just missed it.
Give or take. All right, so why not take the $600 billion that are on programs that we know are creating as many problems probably as they're fixing, if not more, and then do it that way? Like, do you think, because it almost feels like it's a little bit of a stopgap that you'd still have to get to that problem eventually?
Well, that's the beauty of this, the freedom dividend proposal, is that you have the $600 billion or so, and then you're saying, hey, guess what? Like, it's now a new right of citizenship, everyone gets it. And then what's going to happen is you're going to dramatically reduce the enrollment in these programs very, very quickly, because a lot of people will be like, I prefer the cash. And then this new incoming population would just opt for the dividend and then never end up on these welfare programs. So you'd end up shrinking the enrollments over time in the way you describe. You just wouldn't do it all at once because, you know, there are a lot of people in very distinct situations. And this is actually much more politically feasible and popular than going and trying to tear these programs up from the roots up.
Yeah. Are you worried, though?
Hold on for a second. So there are people in different. So he said the reason why you would do it this way because there are people in distinct situations, and it also is politically more palatable to do it this way.
Yeah, it's a non-reformist welfare reform.
But he says, as you described, so I think that seems like agreement with
Ruben.
Yeah,
it seems like an agreement with the frame. And this is where I always come up with the New York slumlord example, which is you hear stories, and it's a common practice in the city, that aggressive landlords get people out who are in rent-stabilized apartments, but maybe they're totally not liquid and cash-strapped. And they offer them something, and I've seen things like insane, like $5,000 to leave an apartment.
Oh, I've seen much bigger.
Or what I'm saying, even less, right? Like, oh, okay. I'm saying as a point of like the long term play for a family is it's better, you know, if you can, to keep that apartment and that housing security, but you're so strapped for cash that you might take that short term deal that makes more sense. So, and I could just, knowing, like, being in a position where maybe cumulatively housing programs, food stamps, and so on is what's literally keeping a roof over your head. But if you have absolutely no cash flow, the appeal of the immediate sort of payoff is going to be very strong. And it might be a really bad long-term bargain for people that are really vulnerable. Well, and that's why I have a fundamental problem with that.
The long-term bargain is that you're weakening the existence of these programs.
Precisely.
And so it's a political one. I mean, look. I'm trying to figure out what the $600 billion is that they're referring to, right? I mean, because this guy, I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. He either knows what Dave Rubin's talking about when Dave Rubin says $600 billion annually, or he doesn't. And if he doesn't, he should. All right, let's go before that.
So why not just blow apart? So I think the best libertarian argument that I've heard for UBI is that basically if you want to do UBI, it's got the right idea. Why not just blow apart the social safety net as is? Take, because we know it's just a boondoggle of middle management nonsense with all the whacked out incentives that you're talking about. Why not just take all of that money, which do we even know how much money is actually not put into these things?
Of course.
So how much right now?
$600 billion, give or take.
Give or take. All right, so why not take the $600
Oh, okay. So his $600 billion. So what I'm curious what he's talking about. Because I mean, it's not Medicaid and it's not Medicaid presumably. It's not CHIP, right? Which is children's health insurance programs that are add-ons to that. TAMF is federal block grants. I don't like block grants. That's problematic because you're leaving it up to the state to distribute it, but that's basically the best they could do. You have the earned income tax credit, which is basically a payment. You have the child tax credit. You have WIC, which is special nutrition program for women, infants, and children. Right? Like, when you have babies, it may be your need for money is more and maybe different than it would be a couple years later when you get that extra grand. And I guess maybe the idea is like, well, you should have saved to, you know, in anticipation of this. I don't know. SSDI is not part of that, according to according to what you've just told me, Matt, that's about $140 billion. You have SNAP, which is food stamps. And we had a record number of people who needed SNAP in the wake of the financial crisis. That may drop down from like 40 some odd million people down, a million or two, which is based upon the growth of the country, you know, a lower percentage of people. But that kicks in automatically. Social Security, Supplemental Security Income, SSI, provides need-based assistance to disabled or elderly people with little income and few assets. Now, maybe giving them $1,000 a month would be better than what they get under that. But I don't know. I mean, I have no problem with giving people cash. It's just I'm not quite clear. Is this what it is here?
This is one of the big Yang Gang proponents talking about how SSDI will exist on top of the freedom dividend. SSI will not. And he has this graph here.
Okay, so in thousands. So I guess about 5 million people. They'd get rid of payments to 5 million people who are on, or 2.5 million people on, yeah, I don't know.
So if you got, like, say, 700 in SSI, I mean.
Here's the thing. What I think is so problematic about this is that so much of the value of this program is contingent upon the being able to do this with precision. And my complaint with the UBI is exactly what it was 2 or 3 years ago, which is there is a political process, and to ignore a political process, like I can tell you right now, Bernie's plan to forgive all debt, it goes through the meat grinder of, the chances of him being able to go in there without, obviously, without Democrats in control of both houses is, you know, him getting that passed is obviously very low. it creates a political movement, and maybe you get there. But let's just assume that they were able to get something passed. And that bill gets into the Senate and the House, and it gets completely mangled. If the worst case scenario is like only half of the people get half of their debt, that's still good. Like, you have a lot of latitude when the policy is we think there should be less college debt. You have a lot of latitude as to where it lands, where you're not going to come out with something that is worse. Right? Like, there's no way Bernie's proposal or Warren's proposal or even the like Julian Castro's proposal is going to come out being more problematic. My fear with the UBI is that 5 years down the road, you've now, according to Yang, found a politically palatable way of getting rid of these things. People have opted out of them by their own choice, their own free will. They have opted out of them. And then 5, 10 years down the road, it's all a payment system. And then they start working on cutting that.
Absolutely. And I think the other thing that, I mean, just a couple other things to note that are very concerning to me is that one, I'm not trying to question his motives, honestly. I know that this will be the way it's interpreted, but there's different tunes depending on who he's talking to. There's definitely sometimes where it sounds like he's pushing a plan that is what we're talking about, which is on top of and addition to. When he's talking to Ruben right there, he sounds like Charles Murray to me. He's buying into, and
yeah,
but I think the other thing is, like, again, let's just be blunt. This guy is not going to be elected president. And if he wants to run a campaign that is about, you know, robotics replacing workers, which I think is questionable too, there needs to be some interrogation of some of those assumptions, and that a UBI is the answer, then you don't need to get into all of the various machinations of how you're going to undermine other programs. You can really just run an issue campaign because that's the purpose. So when you have that, you know, when you're just running a media issue campaign and you're insisting on putting other things on the table to pay for something that isn't going to happen, that to me is also very questionable.
Well, what Sam just described reminds me in a gross and creepy way of the concept of the non-reformist reform, right? Which is something often used by the socialist left to mean a reform that somehow picks up its own speed and moves us closer to a socialist horizon, right? The horizon that he wants to move us closer to seems to be some kind of dystopian techno-libertarian horizon. So the UBI, like you said, would be used to sort of abolish the welfare state in more of a gradual way, which is why I'm referring to it as non-reformist welfare reform, because welfare reform was a horribly cruel program of austerity implemented by Bill Clinton in the 90s. And it seems like that's the horizon he's looking towards.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just going by his what he said.
That's what he
said.
I'm not making
any assessment on why he said it or what he's doing or if he has some other agenda. I have no idea. I'm just going by what he said, and I don't like the sound of it. I don't like the sound of you know. You could also, that's what they were going to try and do, frankly, with Social Security. They were going to try and privatize it. Give people the option of putting their Social Security money in the private stock market. Again, leaving it up to the individuals. And it would be a disaster from a policy standpoint. I also, frankly, don't think we should do that with vaccinations either. There's a whole host of things that I don't think that we should allow people to choose in terms of what the government does. Because the individual's best interest is not necessarily the best interest of society. That's just the reality.
It also seems like a way around the labor issues that come with increasing automation. Like Michael was saying that, you know, he's skeptical of the idea of automation. I think it's a really great idea. But if we don't accompany that with real political changes and changes in the social relations of how we make things and how we reproduce our society, it's not going to be good.
Well, I always say worry about capitalism, not robots. But
yes, exactly.
Yeah, I mean,
like AOC said, the problem that people like, it should be a good thing that robots are replacing workers because it means we have more leisure time. But if we still have the same system where we all need to have jobs in order to survive and work 40 hours a week, then it becomes sinister.
Right. Well, I mean, this is a theory. That's why a theory with all technology that's introduced on some level, right? Like, this is going to make me so much more efficient. It's also going to make me on call 24 hours a day. And as everyone else gets just more efficient, I'm going to be expected to have X amount of percentage more efficiency and more productivity. And that's basically the way it works. All right, look, should we do this now or should we go into the fun half with this?
Let's just do it.
Wow, we have a little bit of conflict.
We have
in
a
the
conflict.
Office.
I'm willing to stand down. I'm not invested in this.
All right,
wait till
this
the fun
is for
half.
Members. We're going to do this. We're going to play the blockbuster Project Veritas video. And
I wonder why we're playing this, frankly.
And then, because it's important and because we're pursuing the truth. We'll, of course, cut out certain names that we don't like appearing in it, but we will do this in the fun half. Folks, just a reminder, you can support this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. It is your membership that makes this show possible. And when you join, you get access to the fun half. You, I guess that's more or less about it. I mean, you get bragging rights. I don't know who you're going to find where that carries any huge weight. But you could do it and just enjoy how people are looking at you like, what are you talking about? But you know. And that's really all that's important. So go in, become a member, join themajorityreport.com, go into work the next day, brag about it to everybody. They're all going to look at you like you're weird, but you know that you're not. It's they're the weird ones.
Hey, it might get you laid at the Netroots Nation conference.
I mean, I can tell you from experience that it probably won't, but it could. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. Today is Tuesday. Oh,
how you doing?
Good. What are you doing?
Well,
look
tonight.
At you. What are you going to do now that it's summer? You can't wear your Adidas tracksuits.
Well, I wear my free Lula shirt on the day of Lula's hearing at the Brazilian Supreme Court.
Okay. Or as you would say, why is it at the American Supreme Court?
I asked you. What
I said, I thought Supreme Court was kind of self-explanatory that it would be the country's Supreme Court.
I would imagine.
Fine. Yep. No, you said, why is he at the American
Supreme
Court?
No, I said...
Court?
The U.S. Supreme Court?
The U.S. Supreme Court?
And you said yes.
I said yes because I thought it was an intentionally stupid question and I was joking with you.
I was talking about the U.S. Supreme Court.
The U.S. Supreme Court. Lula's coming tonight.
Sounds like it's going to be a great
Harvey
show.
Harvey K. is here in studio. We're talking about the Wisconsin uprising, Bernie's speech. Brian Mayer from Brazil Wire and Telesaur is joining us as well to talk about those Supreme Court hearings and how... The Guardian, the New York Times, and Jimmy Dore, the U.S. Supreme Court's hearings on Lula, exactly, Sam, and how the Guardian, the New York Times, and Jimmy Dore failed the Lava Jato coverage and what that has to teach us about how to cover, quote-unquote, corruption moving forward, particularly in places the U.S. is invested in Latin America. This Sunday for patrons, Bill Fletcher Jr. on the Democratic Party and the Gramscian War of Positions and how the progressive movement relates to it. Also, get your tickets to our Chicago live show, patreon.com/TMBS. See you tonight at 7.
Jamie.
This week on the Antifada. So I feel like it's been a million years since I've been in the office, the studio, but I'm going to do my best at this plug here. So last week we spoke with our friend Sophie Wiener, night editor of Splinter News, about her very cool socialist techno zine that she started called Pluralitariat, about nightlife, socialism, and how to use nightlife as a radical space to spread socialism. Friday, we released a bonus for our patrons that, if I do say so myself, was pretty funny. We read the infamous crime think essay, Washing, ... or brainwashing, about how cleanliness is a capitalist conspiracy
to make you feel
bad about yourself and sell you things.
Fake news.
And coming up this week, we have Chad Vigorous, a.k.a. Pretty Bad Lefty, for a wide-ranging conversation on race, identity, politics, and even a little bit of electoral stuff. So check it out.
Matt.
Literary Hangover. Just under 3 hours on Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Blithedale Romance, on the utopian socialists and why both Nathaniel Hawthorne and the guy who founded the New York Times were against them.
Darn it, I guess I have my wow on the other one, don't I? I get that. Oh! I was going to do the wow after the 3 hours. All right, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 boy, back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Almost as what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danerke's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danerke.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break for people.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck. Reminder.
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are...
Psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What?
Almost says what?
Hell of a lot of bank.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black Africans. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them! Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black.
Pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.